I hate a song that makes you think that you're not any good. I hate a song that makes you think that you're just born to lose, bound to lose, no good to nobody, no good for nothing, because you're either too old or too young or too fat or too slim or too ugly or too this or too that. Songs that run you down or songs that poke fun at you on account of your bad luck or your hard traveling. I'm out to fight those kinds of songs to my very last breath of air and my last drop of blood. I am out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, that if it has hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down or rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that make you take pride in yourself and in your work. And the songs I sing are made up, for the most part, by all sorts of folks just about like you.
Welcome to Ungagged, the pre-election special. The pre-election special will be released next week. On this week's Strong, Stable and Poll-Beating podcast, we will be hearing a special election night Jeremy Vine special oral graphic exit poll imagining by Steve McAuliffe, Chuck Hamilton's second part in his series, Derek McPherson will be telling us of his spin cycle, nothing to do with a washing machine, I can promise you. M. Dehaney is strong and stable. Fouad Alakbarov is going to be talking about the NHS. Simone Charlesworth on fox hunting. Theresa Durren on making a difference. And we Rafe on kicking out the Tories. Excuse my Scottish accent. We'll also be hearing from a great activist, Ron Mackay, who passed away this week at the age of 93. Ron will always be remembered by those who got to know him through the Scottish Communist Party, the SSP, CND, and his local political and community activities. Ron, on hearing the news of the atom bomb on Hiroshima when he was posted in India during the war to work on the new radar system, vowed to fight the development and use of these dreadful machines of death. He was arrested when the US missile Polaris system was delivered to the Holy Lock in Scotland in the early 60s, because he wanted to ensure that his arrest was on the record as part of the struggle against nukes, against the advice of his head teacher. Ron was a physics and maths teacher. He was never promoted in Glasgow. Ron's huge energy for helping in the fight for a fairer world was still outstripping us only a matter of months ago, and a visit to his house even in the past few months was one in which he was writing letters and suggesting solutions to some of the awful machinations of the right. Ron at various political meetings used to sit patiently and listen to our debates and discussions, the same sorts of debates and discussions I'm very sure he had heard thousands of times during his life as a Communist Party member and as the son of a very active Communist Party member and conscientious objector. And then, sagely, he would bring us all together with his wider view of the problems of war and poverty and how we could and should be fighting together as socialists to end both of these capitalist scourges. Ron got a special mention in the Scottish Parliament last week thanks to Green MSP Ross Greer. Ron was an incredibly kind man. The goodwill will not be interred with him. He has inspired many, many people.
In 1942... when I just started my second year of a science course at Glasgow University, I was called up. I joined the Royal Navy. I was trained to service the then secret weapon radar. I was sent to India, where I remained until 1945. On the 6th of August 1945, I was in Madras, southern India, for VE Day celebrations. In spite of the horror of Hiroshima, like some of the other service personnel, I thought that the enormous destructive power of nuclear weapons would make big wars impossible in the future. Clement Attlee apparently thought that too, but the US President Harry Truman persuaded Attlee that banning the bomb, which at that time only the US possessed, was not best policy. 50 years ago, General Eisenhower warned of the threat to peace of the military-industrial complex. The military-industrial complex nowadays dominates the United States. I'm a long-time member of CND. I've protested at Aldermaston, Dunoon and Fast Lane many times. I'm very worried at international developments. Russia has nuclear weapons, they're all in Russia. China has nuclear weapons, they're all in China. The US has nuclear weapons, but they're in Germany, Poland, Turkey, and bases around Russia. NATO is an aggressive military-armed alliance under US control. Professor Tyler, a US economist, says we need a big war to settle the economy. A number of voices in America have expressed this opinion. John Tolger reports the US Congress Resolution 758 in a nutshell says, let's get ready for war with Russia. Amazon recently displayed a book, Winter Kill, The War with China Has Already Begun. There have been already two world wars essentially caused by economic problems. Are we to have a third? We are 30 miles here from the nuclear arms dump. The position is very serious. The planet is in its most dangerous situation ever. The present generation has the power to improve life on the planet or to destroy all life on the planet. Many eminent individuals are warning that the situation is extremely serious. Noam Chomsky, John Tolger, Michael Chudovsky, Richard Sackbaugh, Helen Caldicott, and many others have voiced their concern. We've had two world wars caused essentially by economic problems. The big capitalist powers have serious economic problems. Has there to be a third world war? The signs are ominous. The Westminster warmongers are spending billions of pounds, not just on Trident and other nuclear weapons, but on huge military projects. The US policy of perpetual war, which our defence so-called experts slavishly follow, throws a heavy burden on welfare state. Warfare and welfare are incompatible. The media plays a significant part in promoting war propaganda. It is a powerful opponent of the peace forces. We badly need a strong, active socialist peace movement which can accommodate the socialists in the Labour Party, in the SNP, in the Greens, the SSP, the Communist Party, and other socialists, some of whom are in no political party. We have much in common, not just peace, but anti-Trident, anti-austerity, green issues, etc. This need is urgent and vital. This matter should be raised at every meeting held as we approach the elections. As John Tolger says, our responsibility is clear. Expose and identify the reckless lies of the warmongers and never collude with them. He also says, all three liberal newspapers have misrepresented the events in the Ukraine as a malign act by Russia, when in fact the fascist-led coup in the Ukraine was the work of the United States. Russians are being portrayed as the bad guys and NATO as the good guys, when the reverse is probably more true. The prospect of a third world war is not a matter to be left in the hands of the academics and philosophers, but affects us all in our everyday life, our daily lives, and threatens the future of our children.
This is Woody Guthrie.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. The voice was chanting as the fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, the dust clouds rolling, the voice coming chanting, and the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me.
Hi, it's Simone from Glasgow. Yet again we see the same old, portly, gout-ridden faces talking about repealing the 2004 Hunting Act. A free vote was promised in the Conservative 2015 manifesto, and their hubris over what they see as an overwhelming win in the next election has got them all stirred up again. Weird how it's only the harmful promises they managed to keep, like that bloody stupid EU referendum, and not, for example, we will ease pressure on public services in your local community, or even every school needs high standards, proper funding and accountability. Anyway, when asked about it, Theresa May replied, she is personally in favour of fox hunting. Of course you will be. How else would you relax after a hard week as Prime Minister or Home Secretary deporting people, other than by watching a living creature being run to exhaustion and then ripped apart by dogs? Hunting is cruel. If working class people took part, it would be condemned. Hare coursing was banned at the same time, but I don't see it being mourned by the bloodthirsty inbreds and wannabes. Hunts are not a gathering of people on horseback with hounds who just happen to find a fox. Work starts well before the meet. An area known to have foxes will have been selected, and escape routes such as earths and sets will be blocked the night before. At the start of the hunt itself, the area will be surrounded by the hunters on horseback while hounds are sent in to flush out the fox. Once spotted, hunters will call out so the chase can begin. Hounds are slower than foxes but can run for longer. This prolongs the chase, and eventually the fox will be run out, exhausted, surrounded by hounds, and then ripped apart. This is not an activity for animal lovers. The dogs themselves are not treated well. Dogs are literally whipped off if they chase the wrong prey, though God help any cat or dog that is unlucky enough to be caught. The hounds are shot once they are seen as no longer being productive at around 6 to 7 years old. And at a week old, puppies are killed if considered not strong enough. The Countryside Alliance itself estimates 3,000 hounds are killed every year. Retired greyhounds can be rehomed, retired foxhounds not. And as for being pest control, really? It requires a pack of dogs and a group of riders in fancy dress to kill one fox? I've never seen rat catchers make that kind of effort. Before the ban, about 25,000 foxes were killed a year, which is approximately 10% of the UK's 240,000 fox population. Basically, all they were doing was thinning the herd. A hunt has very little effect on the local fox population. Foxes are territorial, and if one fox is killed, another will soon move into the vacated area. It is their food supply that regulates their population, and it appears there has been no evidence of an increase in the fox population since the hunting ban began. And as for being a pest, 90% of agricultural land is used for crops, beef and dairy farming. By keeping the rabbit and rat populations down, the fox is actually an asset to the majority of farmers. there are predations by foxes, but the International Fund for Animal Welfare reports that according to farmers, only 1% of lamb losses are due to fox predation. It is poor animal husbandry that is the major cause of lamb and ewe death. Well-known hunt enthusiast Cameron tried 2 years ago to revoke the act, but the proposal never made it to a vote due to a lack of support from all parties. There is even a Conservatives Against Fox Hunting group who have pointed out that repeal is not an issue amongst voters and that the next Parliament will have enough work to do with Brexit without wasting further time on this issue. The last annual Ipsos Mori poll on the subject showed an all-time high of 84% of people in support of the ban. And when using the Office of National Statistics data to identify where participants lived, it was found that in rural areas, where support from hunting is expected to be greater, 82% of people still oppose fox hunting. This is not a town versus country issue, no matter how much they try to dress it up as such. Wild described hunting as the unspeakable in pursuit of the inedible. It is indeed a cruel and as unacceptable as cockfighting, bull baiting, and dog fighting. If they must dress up and sip sherry before galloping across the fields, fine. However, this is the 21st century, not the 18th, and I think some need reminding of this. So, I've done my mini rant on this and signed a couple of petitions, and now I get to the point. Why, when this is such an unpopular position, have the Tories and press run with it? It's not like Theresa answers any questions without prior knowledge. It's a smokescreen, like the boy jobs and girl jobs. There's so much shite out there, they are using this as a distraction. They'd much rather people talked about it than the CPA letting them get away with buying the last election, or the upcoming shitstorm of Brexit, or the way May is protected by the media, or that nurses and police are using food banks, or that pensions are going to get cut, or that the disabled are going to get hammered again, or that IDS is a sociopathic wanker. Low-value people, Jesus, and he's another so-called Christian. So we make our point, and then we get back to protesting every other bloody thing they are doing. And most importantly, get people to vote these bastards out.
Policemen moving through the train have a right to arrest me if my love is in vain. All my trials, all my trails. Well, tonight I'll get my rhythm from the rails. The train retains my rhythm nightly. I gain it once the sun dips slightly over freshly cut hay bales. Tonight I'll get my rhythm from the rails. Wild thing, she left you this morning. I can't believe she would leave you at all. Rhythm, 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 rhythm. Thank the Lord that the world is not so small. You know I felt the blade of a Turkish barber, open blade, hot blade against my neck. A ship of trade I've seen submerged in half a harbor, sold for scrap, a ship of trade become a wreck. The diesels hum the wind in through my sails, wind into my sails can turn the tide. So chalk your destinations up, my friend, on my wooden wagon sides. Wild thing, she left you this morning. I can't believe she would leave you at all. Rhythm, 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 rhythm. Wild thing, she left you this morning. You never know where the future might call. Thank the Lord that the rails know it all. As we cross the cantilevers, we have all manner of believers. In the blue Canadian Rockies, they had Sam's around sound before they even had talkies. In the blue Canadian Rockies, they had Sam's around sound before they even had talkies. In the blue Canadian Rockies.
Hi, my name's Steve McAuliffe. This is my take on the BBC election night coverage. And now, over to Jeremy Vine.
As you say, David, very early days. Three results in so far, but factoring in the Conservative-funded WeGov exit poll data, these are the projections for how we think and hope things will play out nationwide. And bearing in mind opinion polls exist to steer and not to reflect public opinion, this is what, depending on the trends displayed so far, this is what we see happening as the night progresses. The sleek blue sports car represents the Conservative Party. The rusty old red Soviet era larder car there, of course, Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. The Liberal Democrats, represented by the yellow Prius. All other parties, represented by the recently privatised stagecoach bus there. Now, let's just wind the clock forward. Wind it all the way forward to 2 o'clock. And what we are seeing on current trends, remember, just three votes in so far, but factoring in the Comquat analysis, and there we have it. The Conservatives with a strong lead and holding stable, strong and stable there, way out in front, as you'd expect, on an open stretch of motorway, zooming away. And what have we got here? Oh dear. There's Mr. Corbyn. The bonnet of his car is up. He's in a lay-by. It's raining. He's wet. He's miserable. And by the look of it, he's removed his Breton cap and thrown it into a puddle in exasperation, no doubt. Not good. Not good for Labour at all, as you'd expect. And as we've been telling you for months now. And where's the yellow Prius? Of course, the Liberal Democrats. Oh, there it is. Well, it's merrily poodling along on a country lane, irrelevant but seemingly happy enough, with a picnic in the back. There's a, as you can see there, there's a Don't Follow Me, Follow Jesus bumper sticker proudly displayed there, next to the sticker depicting Margaret Thatcher encased in a love heart, Tim Farron's car, obviously. And what of the Green Party? Well, let's be honest, we prefer to give airtime to UKIP, obviously. And where are they? Just look over there. UKIP leader Paul Nuttall there, depicted in the midst of a fistfight with some foreigners at a service station. And you can see the police are arriving there. So by 2 o'clock, we could safely say the night's over for UKIP already. Though, of course, that won't stop us here at the BBC asking their opinion on every conceivable subject, particularly when we want to ramp up racial tensions and steer the Conservative Party even further to the right. So there we have it. Jeremy Corbyn kicking the puncture tyre of his larder car now as John McDonald weeps over a roadside rubbish bin, and the Tories blazing a trail towards the Brexit cliff and ultimate supreme victory. David.
Jeremy, in the interest of balance, how are the Scottish Nationalists faring on this projection?
Don't know, David. Don't particularly care. Thank you.
The trouble with politicians is that they can never truly understand powerlessness, the powerlessness that comes with the daily grind of poverty, of being unable to affect your environment, of having every aspect of your life out of your control. The reasons more people are visiting food banks are not complex. They're hungry and can't afford to buy food. How they got in that position is more complicated. It is not, as the Tories would have you believe, because they wouldn't knuckle down, work hard, man up, bear down, and just be jolly good chaps. It is due to the housing crisis, the struggling education system, family breakdowns, health inequality, the decimation of disability support, the removal of student bursaries, lack of mental health services and social care failures. And no matter how many times Anne Widdecombe goes and lives with a family on a council estate for a TV show, or how many times Theresa May eats fish and chips in an attempt to resemble a normal human being, as Jarvis Cocker once said, you'll never get it right, because when you're laying in bed at night, watching roaches climb the walls, if you called your dad, he could stop it all. Politicians have no concept of the powerlessness of being what Ian Duncan Smith likes to call a low-value person. And if you look down on the majority of people you are supposed to be representing, people that have voted for you, then how can you ever have their best interests at heart? And with that in mind, I'd like to read a poem by my friend and author of Fat Man Blues, Richard Wall. We're strong and stable, so fuck the disabled, the homeless, the jobless, the poor, and NHS tables and teachers of fables. Fuck you, because we're funding no more. And fuck you to the migrants who could make our land vibrant and eclectic with colour and song. We've let in too many. We need to save pennies. So fuck you and keep jogging on. To the privileged few, we're the government for you. Rest assured there's tax cuts galore. To the rest of you clowns, we're going to keep you slapped down. Buckle in, because there's lots more in store. Because we're strong and we're stable, so bend over the table, because we're going to fuck you some more.
And now the title poem of my latest book, UK Gin Dependence Party. And this is called UK Gin Dependence Party. Now I have to get into character. fascists, are we, dear? Bring that bottle over here. Now, where was I? Enoch Powell. Damn this irritable bow. Do you pay golf? Come down the club. Just a snifter. Lovely grub. What, no blazer? Borrow mine. Gin, gin. Maggie, 79. Now, where was I? Nigel Farage. Dear, more bottles in the garage. Really don't want to disparage, but he should pronounce it Farage. Agincourt of Waterloo showed those Frenchies what to do. On top Cordiel, bloody shame. Wonder how he got that name. Now, where was I? Edward Heath. Awful man with awful teeth. He's the one who started this, led us into the abyss. It would have been so much easier to have teamed up with Rhodesia. Bloody Poles. This gin is strong. Oh, it's vodka. Got that wrong. Now, where was I? Fascists? No, I fought them, I'll have you know. Well, I nearly did. Too young. Something's happening to my tongue. Bloody Poles. I need a kip. Do have one more. Just a nip. Upstairs, ere my senses fail. Eileen, where's the Daily Mail? One last parting shot, young man. Country's going down the pan. Anyone with half a brain is selling up and off to Spain. Part of that's in Europe, true, but not the bit we're going to. Bloody Poles. My poor old head. See yourself out. Off to bed. Chin chin. Thank you.
Hi. Now let me start with the fact that I love the NHS. It's treated family, friends and strangers in difficult times with no judgment and no charge. The best of our country. The big lie that NHS is unsustainable has become dangerously confused with the fact the NHS is underfunded and mismanaged by the Tory government. The privatization of the NHS has continued by stealth with the result of increasing bureaucratization and medicalization of areas such as mental health care. The NHS has the most stressed GPs as a result of relentless workloads, endless bureaucracy, and the shortest amount of time spent with patients. Billions of pounds are being wasted on failed market-driven bureaucracy. Another fact is attack on immigrant doctors. 25% of doctors are non-UK citizens. They are also skilled, talented, dedicated, and keeps the NHS going. The systematic dismantling of the NHS condemns generations of people in the UK. We need more nurses in the NHS because they do an amazing job caring for patients, but currently 2/3 of people aren't accepted for training. Theresa May and her allies don't believe in a compassionate, caring society where everyone does better and we look after those that need it. And it's no greater moment to remember that in Britain we need to vote on June the 8th to save the NHS. Thank you.
Your father's rich and your mother's gay. come over here and say that in my face. Ah, you better run. Bold as brass, by the way. Oh, hello, everybody. Red Rafe here. Your pal in the People's Republic of my street. What a week it's been round here. Even he come belting up the road to tell me that the Tory candidate for our council ward just lived round the corner for me. Well, you can imagine my horror. How the hell did that one slip through the checkpoint? Kirk must have been having a lavy break and the sleek it got slipped through when he wasn't looking. And if it wasn't bad enough, did he not actually get a council seat? A Tory councillor in our village? But hold on, no is all as it seems. I was busy yesterday, so wee Vinnie was keeping me updated on the election results. But I didn't know he was getting the news after BBC. So I'm getting hundreds of desperate tweets and texts about a big Tory search, SNP losses, and all was looking bleak. Then the bombshell. The Tories have taken Glasgow. Well, I nearly fell off my bike at that one. Can you imagine my beloved Jess City turning Tory? Well, a quick search showed me that it wasn't true. The biggest party in Glasgow, with most votes, was actually the SNP. But the BBC so keen to make it look like wee mad Ruth Davison had managed to win over the most socialist city in Scotland for her old scary, weak and wobbly maw, Theresa May, had a star expert on saying the Tories had done just that. Oh, how they must have been cheering at Tory HQ. What a joke. But it's actually not a laughing matter that such a massive mistake was made by a so-called expert. Because the entire election was portrayed as a big Tory victory, even though it was the SNP who won in Scotland. Truth was, the Tory gains was mostly them getting a seat at stage 10, not them winning outright anywhere. Labour is dead here. And what was clear was that the voters turned to a party who had no policies other than to stop another independence referendum. Red Tories turned blue. Folk who wanted Scotland to stay in the UK bizarrely used the council elections to make that point. But you know what? Despite that fact that the Unionists made it all about independence, the SNP still won. Nicola Sturgeon's team made it about actual council issues. And even though everybody knows their goal is to free Scotland from Westminster Clause, the SNP won most votes. So what does that tell us? Well, comrades, it tells us this. Things are really looking good for a massive yes vote in the near future. Oh, and it also tells us that if you're still watching the BBC and believing their bile, you're off your head. Right, it has worked today. General election in a couple of weeks. And as I always say, what can go wrong?
The faction issues urge you to vote Labour to build a socialist alternative, comrades. In the meantime, the best thing you can do is take anyone in your circle of friends who veers to the right and dump them. This one's called Conservative Vote.
Attack it! Conservative! white scars in his gut.
Hello, my name is Teresa, and I'm the good Teresa that it's okay to like. I want to talk about making a difference. Desperate times call for desperate actions. Amongst the options I'm seriously considering in the wake of the recent local election results are sitting on the floor and howling pitifully, drop-kicking a kettle over the garden fence, or selling the cat and instead buying a ticket for a one-way trip to Mars. I can't really do the last of these, to be honest, not least because I don't actually have a cat. I'm probably way too old to be considered for interplanetary travel, and I don't have the necessary O-levels anyway. The fact that I still think in terms of O-levels itself means I'm almost certainly too old. I realise the election results brought good news stories for some good people. Despite initial reports by national broadcasters who really ought to have known better, Plaid Cymru and the SNP did well, and the Green Party made steady gains. Liverpool has a Labour mayor to match London, and Andy Burnham is now the mayor of Greater Manchester, which hopefully marks a return to its radical roots for that city. He had already said that he would give 15% of his salary towards a homeless prevention initiative, saying that we must never accept as a fact of life that for some to succeed, others must sleep rough on our streets. Hearing this said out loud in public made me realise how rarely such a humanitarian and, well, nice sentiment gets airtime in public political discourse, which is perhaps a mark of how low we have fallen. Talking of falling, UKIP's mighty march towards electoral greatness has become more of a drunken stumble as they are reduced to one council seat nationally. As many wags have said, though, they probably still retain their seat at every BBC political discussion programme for the foreseeable future. However pleasant it is to witness their demise, and it is a very sweet sight, it wasn't unpredictable or surprising. Their patented branch of nasty, spiteful, mean and ignorant opinions have now sadly become normalised to such an extent that they will inevitably form part of the Conservative manifesto. I will not say that their opinions are mainstream. They are still firmly based in extreme right-wing xenophobic ignorance, and I will always refuse to accept that as mainstream. It just flows from a toxic river which is currently polluting the mainstream, and I hope this contamination, poisonous it is, turns out to be temporary. Which leads to the big question, how to turn that particular tide? I am at a loss to understand how or why so many people who are or will be personally adversely affected by Tory policies seem unable to bring themselves to vote for anyone else. People seem to be incapable of discerning cause and effect. They will complain about how hard it is to get a GP's appointment, but will still vote for a government which is decimating the NHS by starving it of funds. They will rightly moan about the impossible cost of housing. Private rents where I live are running at around £1,500 a month for a very ordinary three-bedroom terraced house. But they won't let that stop them voting for a party which refuses to take any action to ensure fair rents or replenish local authority housing stock, which could actually change things. Some of this may be due to ignorance. Most people aren't very politically engaged. The average Briton will see something like 2 minutes of political news per week, and many won't even be paying close attention to that. None of the colleagues I spoke to earlier in the week, for example, had even heard of the rape clause child benefits scandal, and these are reasonably intelligent, aware people. This makes concerns about an anti-Labour media bias less significant than you might think, I believe. If there is a bias, many people won't have been paying enough attention to have noticed it. What they will have noticed, however, is the political uncertainty and chaos around at present. The immediate aftermath of the Brexit vote last summer saw an extraordinary degree of instability, with the PM and half the cabinet resigning in short order, followed by frantic jockeying for position amongst the successful Brexiteers, none of whom seemed to have any idea what to do or say or how to behave next. Into this maelstrom sailed Theresa May, and while her robotic demeanour doesn't impress me in the slightest, I can see how she might appear to the casual observer to seem safe and, dare I say it, stable. In times of uncertainty, people will cling to the status quo. The human condition is generally resistant to change at the best of times. Despite the understandable anger which is around at present, I really don't think it's helpful to insult people who do this. You can call me a naive hippie if you like, mainly because I am, but I don't think calling people who you want to persuade to vote your way morons or idiots will help much with the persuasion process. So, what can we do to avoid a Tory landslide on June the 8th? If you're lucky enough to live in Wales, Scotland or Northern Ireland, you will have viable alternatives to vote for. To my southern eyes, it seems that the SNP have built up real momentum since the last Indy referendum, engaging voters with reasoned and passionate arguments, led by a competent and charismatic First Minister. I can't pretend to follow the labyrinthine plot twists within Scottish Labour, but at least there's still a fully functioning anti-Tory alternative party there. Similarly, in Wales, Plaid have a down-to-earth and impressive leader in Leanne Wood. But in England, where the Tories are at their strongest and therefore their most dangerous, what can be done? I live in a constituency which has always had a Tory MP. Last time out saw the strongest ever Labour performance, with decreased Tory support caused by UKIP, but the spineless, gutless and soulless Maria Miller still won by over 11,000 votes, taking 48% to Labour's 27%. The overall turnout, however, was 66.6%, which closely mirrored the figure nationally. The big question then is how much of a difference it would have made if the missing 33.3% could have been persuaded to vote. If everyone could be persuaded that their opinion mattered, if they could have been engaged. A long-term strategy would be to include political process education in schools from a young age. Perhaps people would feel more inclined to vote if they understood how the apparatus of government and democracy worked, rather than thinking it's some obscure, meaningless function carried out in a Gothic palace in distant Westminster by MPs who are part of a self-serving and self-enriching government elite, representing no one but themselves and their own narrow interests. The expenses scandal fed nicely into this disconnect and discontent. It shored up the common perception that politics is nothing to do with and has no effect on the lives of ordinary citizens. In the meantime, though, perhaps we should challenge this view whenever we notice it. Politics is not some remote autonomous automaton sheathed within the much remarked upon Westminster bubble, nor is it simply portly men in ermine costumes solemnly marching along red carpets in some feudal pantomime. It is in fact weaved into the fabric of our lives, hiding in plain sight, waiting for us to notice it and realise the potential power we have over it. If we can each engage with and persuade one non-voter to visit the polling booth, that would be quite something, wouldn't it? And then persuade them to investigate tactical voting to keep out the Tories? The Green Party have already agreed not to stand in several constituencies so as not to split the anti-Tory vote, while Labour and Greens have agreed a progressive alliance to oust Amber Rudd in her Sussex constituency, one of 25 seats targeted by the Progressive Alliance. Open Britain, Best for Britain and Tactical 2017 are also trying hard to educate people about tactical voting. The last Conservative government in 2015 was elected with 36.9% of the votes cast on a 66.4% turnout. This means, of course, that far more people didn't vote for them than did. Apathy and lack of engagement played as big a part in their win as Lyndon Crosby, Rupert Murdoch and that bacon sandwich. Similarly, only 27% of the population voted to leave the EU in the referendum last year. Perhaps this is why there's such scant political education in schools. Perhaps disengagement suits the establishment's purposes very well. An indifferent population is also a supine population. It's about time we swap the culture of indifference for the power of making a difference.
Hello, this is Chuck Hamilton coming to you again from Chattanooga, Tennessee in the U.S. of A., a.k.a. Neverland and the Great Satan. I'm no longer counting Wonderland as a nickname for Yankeeland after being reminded of a Morpheus quote from the movie The Matrix. Quote, "This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes." That Wonderland is where we here at Left Ungagged are trying to take you, so wake up and follow us down the rabbit hole. Welcome to The Meaning of Life, Part 2, Ain't No Power in the Verse. Yes, that's a reference to Joss Whedon's space western Firefly. Under Ireland's 2009 Defamation Act, a person who publishes or utters blasphemous matter shall be guilty of an offense and shall be liable upon conviction on indictment to pay a fine of not exceeding 25,000 euros. Seriously, Doyle Aaron, what the fuck? Have you heard of the 21st century? And if there were a god or gods, he, she, it, they sure as hell wouldn't need you to stick up for him, her, it, them. "Man is an animal," wrote anthropologist Clifford Geertz, "suspended in a web of significance he himself has spun." On planet Terra, Earth, of the solar planetary system in Orion's spur of the Milky Way galaxy in the local galaxy group of the Virgo galaxy cluster in the Laniakea supercluster of the universe during the Anthropocene chron of the subatlantic stage of the Holocene epoch of the Quaternary period in the Cenozoic era of the Phanerozoic eon of the current super eon in galactic year 20. Jews believe that Adonai speaks Hebrew, Muslims that Allah speaks Arabic, American evangelicals that Almighty God speaks Elizabethan English, Roman Catholics that Dominus Dei speaks Latin, Eastern Orthodox that Kyrios speaks Greek, Hindus that Brahman speaks Sanskrit, Zoroastrians that Ormazd speaks Avestan, Buddhists that Adi Buddha speaks Pali, Shintoists that Amaterasu speaks Japanese, religious Taoists that Tari speaks Mandarin Chinese, and Sikhs that Vaheguru speaks Punjabi. Each of these groups, and each subgroup and splinter and cult and sect within each of them, believes that they are the chosen people from which will come the Anointed One to assert their rightful dominion over all creation for all eternity. That belief is absurd. In fact, all belief is absurd. To believe is to define. To define is to limit. To limit is to control. To control is to corrupt. Belief is not humble, it is aggressive. Belief is not a sign of submission, it is an assertion of domination. Belief makes itself superior to that in which it claims to believe by controlling it through the very act of belief. Thus, belief is blasphemy. Belief is vanity. Belief is futility. Belief is the very antithesis of faith. At the opposite end, disbelief affirms belief by that very negation, which is another attempt at control. To have faith, one must surrender control. To surrender control, one must abandon limitation. To abandon limitation, one must give up definition. To give up definition, one must let go of belief. To have faith, one must neither believe nor disbelieve. One must unbelieve. There is no higher power in the verse, no supreme being, no divine creator, redeemer, transformer, especially not an anthropomorphic or an anthropopathic God, such as humans repeatedly create in their own image, with whom to have an illusory personal relationship, an illusion of an illusion with an illusion. Every form of ultimate reality conceived and believed by human world, religion, and philosophy, each of which is geocentric and anthropofocal, is too small for our universe. Even in the very rare instances in which humans have perceived an ultimate reality that is something genuinely other, they have proceeded to append to that insight intermediary realities to connect it to our own in order to believe, define, limit, and control, reducing fairly advanced intellectual and spiritual concepts to mere ideological dogma. As the hymn of creation in the Rig Veda admits, the gods themselves are later than creation. To state categorically that there is nothing beyond what we see with our five senses, however, is as unscientific as religion. For all we know, that something may be so far outside our ken that it is as invisible to us as the tall sailing ships of invading Europeans initially were to the native peoples of the Western Hemisphere whom their passengers were about to conquer, kill, rape, and plunder. In Somerset Maugham's The Razor's Edge, protagonist Larry Darrell said, "A God that can be understood is no God." So, if there is something that was before all time, is now, and will be even after the end of time, with time here being defined as the lifespan of the current universe, it is beyond personhood, beyond being, beyond effability. If there is something, it produces yet claims no possession. It redeems yet requires no gratitude. It sustains yet exercises no authority. It has no need of obedience, worship, prayer, praise, adoration, supplication, benediction, love, or even respect. It just is. If there is something, it is both perpetual and ever-changing, flowing through and animating all that is throughout space, time, and beyond. transcendent yet immanent, metacosmic yet omnipresent, eternal yet omnitemporal. If there is something, it has no name. It has no need of a name. Since it is the one and only something, there is no other something from which to distinguish itself. If there is something that is the source of all it is, the core shaping its formation, and the force energizing its manifestation. From our perspective, these are different things, but in reality, they are one. If there is something, it is neither male nor female. It does not take sides nor have sides. From it emanate both light and dark, good and evil, order and chaos, yin and yang, life and death, integrity and entropy, creation and destruction, everything and nothing. Each of those antitheses is defined by its opposite. Without their counterpoints, none of them can exist. And the fact that those opposites exist in competition with each other is what gives us choice, the choice which is the definition of freedom. And without death, life has no meaning. The essence of all life, of all existence, is change and evolution. The nature of time is this. The future has already happened, and the past is yet to be. And the moment where we are now is the beginning and the end, and every moment in between. Tune in next time for The Meaning of Life, Part 3, No Gods, No Masters. And now a word about the upcoming UK general election. Voting Tory is like burning down your own flat while you're still in it. If you're in Scotland, vote Scottish National. If you're in England, vote Labour. If you're in Wales, vote Plaid Cymru or Labour, whichever candidate has a better chance of beating the Tory. Women and younger adults especially, please come out and vote. Your life depends on it, and your votes collectively can change everything. The seven-year siege and plunder of the UK by the Lords of Misrule and their Feast of Fools has to end. The alternative is four more years of Tory malgovernment and the budding Trumpet as Prime Minister. If you want to see what the end result of that will be, look west across the pond. Finally, a shout-out to the Palestinians on hunger strike in the jails and prisons of the State of Israel. Many there without warrant or even charge, and to those supporting them in Palestine and all across the world. Sayati yam lana, inshallah. Igar laha, our day will come. Keep the faith. Peace out.
Two, one, two, three, four.